The same religion that's capable of hideous acts of destruction can also be capable of moments of healing, of restoration, and of hope.
But educate a girl, and you educate her entire family.
There is a son within every person.
When that anger sets in, write it. Write the letters, but don't send them. You never want to leave concrete proof of insanity.
For inviting me to give this lecture at this fascinating Center for Department of Religious Studies, where I know many of you and appreciate the broad expanse of the intellectual project. I had the pleasure of meeting Ninian Smart a few years ago and was thought I was in the presence of a Buddha-like wise man. It was very exciting, and I'm pleased that colleagues at the University of Lancaster, such a fantastic university, are listening on the other side of the ocean. So, as Roger mentioned, I've been working with a late Durkheimian approach, which I've reinterpreted in my early work Durkheim as a symbolic theorist whose aim wasn't to understand religion, but to understand the religious dimension of secular society. Religion defined in the sense of ritualistic symbolic behavior organized in a classification system of sacred and profane, purity and danger. And that has continued to inform my work today, and that's the basic background. I've, in the last few years, moved into trying to have a more action-oriented understanding of this through developing a sociological theory of performance, which I published a book with a couple of other people last year called Social Performance. So that is the background of this, and I don't mean performance as something fake, although, as we'll see, there's a lot of fakiness in some of the performance I'm talking about. So social action is performative. Individual and collective action communicates meaning, consciously or not, to an audience who must read that behavior. This approach grounds social action in meanings, but not in meaning alone. Meaning is attributed to actions by audiences against the background of previously existing collective representations, which are structured by the division between the sacred and profane. Such meaning attribution provides what Austin called the locutionary dimension of performativity. But actors must propitiate the gods of illocution and perlocution as well. I want to consider first the September 11th strike as a performance. If we want to understand 9/11, we must begin with background representations. For more than a millennium, Christians and Muslims have engaged in extravagant misunderstandings of one another. The reasons for this tragic history of conflict obviously cannot concern us here. It's recorded in, and this is important, whatever the origins, it's recorded in and projected by thousands of stories, written tracts, and in modern times, television and film. It is the cultural reality, the set of signifiers, the stereotype constructions that constitute social imaginaries, that underlies millions, what millions in the West and the East think that they observe today. actual occurrences in the conflict between, quote, East and, quote, West become events insofar as they are typified by these background signifiers. Contingent events become the signifieds of these background signifiers. Specifications and refractions of barely changing structures, they form the speech acts of the social languages that mark out the politics of the sacred and profane. Against these background representations, Osama bin Laden's exercise of violent power on September 11th was seen as lucid and compelling to many on the, quote, Eastern side. It was seen as reparation, experienced as revenge, perhaps even as promised liberation. But if bin Laden's attack made sense, if it achieved a semantic location, this did not mean that his performance would necessarily achieve success in pragmatic terms. Radical Islamist groups, especially those trained in the anti-Soviet insurgency in Afghanistan, all had access to these same background representations. What made bin Laden different was his ability to make this Occidentalist literature walk and talk. To understand what it means to achieve not only locutionary, but illocutionary and perlocutionary force, the other elements of social performance have to be brought into play to make a successful, pragmatic cultural event. For example, the script. There always has to be a script to a performance. Bin Laden and his lieutenants actually wrote out detailed plans for the September 11th attack, including preparations and training, directions of movement and time, entrances and exits, etc. The script ranged from the why, bringing the Western devil to its knees, showing its cowardice, making it withdraw from Saudi Arabia, all the way down to the how details of how to fly a plane, how to get through airport security. The script gave the why and how almost like a movie thriller. So you have the background representations, you have the action-specific foregrounded script. You need actors, of course. To prepare for the performance, bin Laden assembled, with painstaking effort, a cast of less than 20 actors, supported by a big background crew. They were superbly trained and carried out difficult parts and made many rehearsals in various camps. Another element of performance, you need to have access to and control over the means of symbolic production. This is perhaps bin Laden's most creative and significant innovation in terms of the cultural pragmatic requirements for performance. The large passenger planes were not only cruelly effective in the instrumental sense, but powerfully expressive weapons in the dramaturgical sense, and they were cheap and relatively easy to obtain. The twin towers against which these new weapons were aimed performed as equally evocative symbols. The metonymic juxtaposition of planes and towers created a global stage for the performance of political murder, capturing the world's media attention. Another element of performance is social power. It has often been said that bin Laden did not have access to significant social power, which, after all, is what defines asymmetrical warfare. But he did, in fact, have considerable physical and financial leverage. He controlled spaces, influence, and governmental powers, first in Sudan and then later in Afghanistan and Pakistan. This access to social power was critical in allowing the terrorist performance to be launched, providing not only arenas for rehearsal, but financial and ideological networks, allowing theologically and pragmatically legitimate promises of salvation to be made to martyrs and families. Another element of performance critical is the mise-en-scene. Bin Laden and his staff's directorial effectiveness could not be faulted. They thought through thoroughly the technical requisites for putting the elements of performance into the scene. And finally, the audience. Even with all these other elements in place that I've mentioned, Bin Laden's performance on September 11th was not assured success. There remained the audiences to contend with. The final performative component, whose relative independence from the others is extremely important. In considering the audiences, we confront an issue that's critical to considering the performance of power in complex, socially and culturally fragmented societies, and why power is actually very difficult to wield successfully. For the sake of simplification, and this is indeed grossly to simplify, let us say there were two audiences for the act, the home or Arab audience and the away or Western one. With the first audience, the performance of terror was virtually a complete success. As Bin Laden remarked in a later videotape, quote, "The brothers who heard the news were overjoyed by it." Was the Western audience, layered from New York outward, convinced themselves by the terrorist actors and their script? If so, this would suggest that on September 11th, Bin Laden had exercised power in a successful manner. And the answer to this question obviously depends on one's estimation of what it was Bin Laden and Al-Qaeda consciously or unconsciously wanted to perform. That's always difficult. Minimally, I think they wished to communicate power and danger. Maximally, they hoped to overwhelm and degrade the collective identity of the United States. By creating subjective weakness and disintegration, the attack would force submission, the term within which Bin Laden has continued to couch his demands to the West today. Certainly, Bin Laden wanted the American audience to experience his terrorist action as power and as danger, but he hoped also to teach Americans about the integrity and purity of Arab land and the transcendence and righteousness of Islamic faith. I'd say the September 11th attacks succeeded in their minimal ambition, but not in their maximal one. Now I'd like to speak about from trauma to triumph, re-signifying the terror as civil and military communitas. 9/11 was obviously experienced as a vast trauma. The trauma lingered and affected Americans for long afterward. It marked a palpably new sense of America as a vulnerable nation, as a potential victim. It wouldn't be an exaggeration to say that in the weeks and months after 9/11, fear stalked the land. Yet, far from undermining American collective identity, this fear and danger actually enraged and energized it to such an extent that it triggered a series of counter-performances that would themselves eventually trigger counter-performances in turn. From the perspective of the terrorist actors and their directors slash leaders, the inner life of the enemy is somehow connected to its physical manifestations. It is believed or half believed that if terrorism destroys the material structures of the enemy society and the biological bodies of enemy persons, it will, by virtue of such destruction, destroy the inner life of the collectivity and its individual members. This working proposition, however, overlooks the spiritual core of every society's collective life and every individual's self. That on the evening of the attacks, President George W. Bush spoke to the spiritual core and associated himself with it goes far to explaining his own purification in its aftermath, as indicated, for example, in the extraordinary spike in his poll ratings. Quote, "Those acts of mass murder were intended to frighten our nation into chaos and retreat," the president declared, "but they have failed." The reason? Quote, "Our country is strong. Terrorist acts can shake the foundations of our biggest buildings, but they cannot touch the foundation of America." The president, for once, was right. From the smoldering ashes of destruction, there emerged an American counterperformance of strength, not weakness, of triumph, not trauma. This revivification of what Victor Turner might have called civil communitas pointed not to the destruction but the vitality of America's collective identity as a democratic and civil nation. For the American audience then, the terror of 9/11 had a counter-signifying effect. The explosions pushed the things and people it touched and destroyed, that it touched and destroyed, the material reference of the signs from the profane to the sacred side of American cultural life. The Twin Towers had been signified as ugly and mercantile, globs of materialism that marred the view of the Statue of Liberty. In the pathetic afterglow of 9/11, they were now symbolized as things of great energy, beauty, and democracy. The economic elite working inside the towers had been the object of disdain and aspersion. Think Michael Douglas, the Academy Award-winning arch-villain of the movie Wall Street. Post 9/11, this elite was spoken of in hallowed tones, sanctified by its association with the ethnic, heroic working class of firemen and policemen. New York City, too, was neatly shifted in its frame from polluted outcast to the purified by fire center of American democratic life. The movement, this movement from trauma to triumph, was not only civil in its transforming power, however, it was also military. It revived not only civil community, but the community of warriors, the ancient band of brothers, the nation in its primordial and primitive, not democratic and modern guise. This ritual revivification had nothing to do with the civility or inclusion and everything to do with the ethic of manly struggle. The roots of this ethic lay outside of Christian civilization. It emerged from within the Republican warrior cultures of Greece and Rome, whose archetypes have continued to energize and deplete Western civilization today. The United States is not only a democratic but a warrior nation. It was founded and twice refounded, not only by Puritan Covenant, Bill of Rights, and Reconstruction era amendments, but by Indian Wars, a long military struggle against Britain, and a much bloodier civil war. In the 150 years since, the American Republic has been engaged in more or less continuous war on behalf of itself and others. In this Republican warrior nation, we find the language of friend and enemy, not in the civil and Madisonian, but in the Schmittian sense. America's counter-performance to terror, in other words, was not only about the reconstruction of civil community, with the emphasis on solidarity, autonomy, and equality. It was also about reconstructing the technical and organizational capacity to project military power and the moral capacity to sustain hierarchy, discipline, command, and control. If we examine the front page of the very liberal New York Times on the morning after the attack, September 12th, it is this militarizing frame of aggression and defense that we see everywhere deployed. Banner headline, U.S. attacked. Next, hijacked jets destroy Twin Towers and hit Pentagon in day of terror. And then a series of subheads, a creeping horror. Buildings burn and fall. President vows to exact punishment for evil. As onlookers search for elusive safety. That's the front page of the most liberal newspaper in the United States, inscribing the national reaction. Where is that? Is that civil or is that military? In his front page story entitled Awaiting the Aftershocks, the legendary New York Times reporter R.W. Appel, who first distinguished himself for critical reporting on the Vietnam War, wrote that, quote, the astonishingly well-coordinated attacks on the World Trade Center had, quote, plunged the nation into a warlike struggle against an enemy that will be hard to identify with certainty and hard to punish with precision. On its back page, the Times' lone conservative William Safire entitled his column, New Day of Infamy, metaphorically associating the attacks with President Franklin Roosevelt's iconic characterization of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor almost 60 years before. Defining the attacks of 9/11 in terms of war, in other words, was a result neither of cabal nor neoconservative ideology. It was rooted rather in the political culture widely shared of the Republican nation. Just so, the counter-signifying process concerned not only civil communitas, but military reconstruction. It triggered the movement from attacked to attacker, from victim to victor, from civilian to soldier. The invasion of Afghanistan and destruction of the Taliban were acts of recapturing or controlling the mise-en-scene, the putting into the scene of both of these triumphant civil and military scripts. This military performance made metaphoric and metonymic sense. It entered physically the metonymic and symbolically the metaphoric into the heart of darkness that had endangered the American nation. I'm talking here of myth. I'm hermeneutically reconstructing the mythical reference of a series of pragmatic actions. It challenged the symbolic and the physically profane. The skillful military invasion and scattering of the Taliban were meaningfully compelling and pragmatically effective. I'd now like to turn to a longer section, from triumph to trauma, military counterperformances as success and failure. In dramaturgical terms, the Afghan invasion, launched only weeks after the terrorist attacks, fused the separate elements of this American counterperformance into an apparently seamless whole. It was viewed by American and Western audiences more broadly as possessing authenticity and verisimilitude, constituting a solidarizing quasi-ritual. The invasion linked the Democrat and the warrior, the communitas of civil and military life. This successful performance created an enormously satisfying, if short-lived, triumph, which seemed to correct, in cosmic terms, the trauma of 9/11. The Iraq War that followed can be viewed in performative terms as a sequel or even as a trequel. Who were the directors of this new performance? Certainly the American president, his staff and cabinet members, his military chiefs, and their field officers. These were the people who brought guns, soldiers, scripts, and cameras together for the dramatic battle. But behind them were the producers of the performance, the forces who facilitated its production. They were less visible, rather secretive, a determined group of neoconservative strategists and ideologues. They were never on location, but they pulled the strings, created the basic frames of reference long before a word was written, and long before actors were chosen for the actual event. These conservative producers were at once deeply idealistic about the possibilities of democratic reconstruction globally and in the Middle East, and deeply cynical about democratic processes at home. They were hard-eyed realists who saw themselves through rose-colored glasses as Republican warriors, and their opponents, both inside and outside the U.S., as dangerous and corrupted enemies. For most of the decade preceding the second Bush presidency, these so-called Vulcans, the name they applied to themselves, had been itching to invade Iraq and overthrow Saddam. Now, with the great success of the first and second acts of the counterperformance from trauma to triumph, these determined ideologues seized the opportunity. To the American people, they presented the Iraqi invasion as the drama's third act, an iteration, in Derrida's sense, of the earlier smash hit performances. It constituted a telos, a narrative denouement that would bring down the curtain to standing ovations. The revival of America's civil and military communitas would be fully achieved. The arc of counter-signification would be complete. After social performances end, they constitute collective memories, providing representations that background subsequent performances in turn. This was certainly the case for the Afghan invasion, which was fought metaphorically and metonymically with the martyrdoms and the triumphs of the Up From Ashes aftermath of 9/11 firmly in mind. The residue of the Afghan success, in turn, left glowing nuggets of collective memory for the would-be Iraqi revival that followed. One big question remained, however. Even if the background representations for this third act were readily available, would the other elements of performance fall into place? Let's begin with the problems of scripting, which must assemble and foreground codes and narratives either proscriptively or retroactively from background representations. To create a hermeneutically effective script is not easy, as anybody in Hollywood will tell you. To persuasively and not only physically fight Saddam, to be allowed and encouraged, in other words, to start a second Iraq war, a new action-specific script would have to be created, one that would mediate between triumphant background representations and the pragmatics of the here and now. After establishing a coherent interface between realistic exigencies and background symbolic structure, this scripted coding and narrating would have to fold into, or at least seem to complement, the requirements for successful performance that remained. It would have to help generate authentic acting. It would have to adapt to and help generate access to and control over the means of symbolic production. It would have to be open to, as well as defend against, the resources of hovering social powers. The script would have to complement the flow of mise-en-scène, the unfolding of the invasion and its aftermath on the ground. Last but not least, it would have to calibrate a fit between message and audiences. This calibrating is made even more difficult because audiences can only be imagined prospectively. Their actual boundaries are retrospectively mapped by consensual interpretation. Good scripts must be agonistic, coding actors into the binaries of sacred and profane, good and evil. And they have to narrate a plot that has beguiling beginnings, ambiguous middles, and cathartic ends. Most good scripts also strive for clarity and concision. These are hermeneutical requirements, and they point to the first problem that scripting the Iraqi invasion encountered on the ground. Because it was easy to describe Saddam as evil, but not to give the civility sufficient weight. Without writing the protagonist as seriously evil, the script's invasion could not be read as fateful, as adumbrating an imminent and decisive triumph. Only a crusade could sustain a narrative of blood sacrifice and war. The script writers of the Iraq War faced an immense hermeneutic challenge, and this explains their two most important lies. One way to thicken Saddam's evility was to connect him to the earlier trauma that had justified the immediately preceding war. Despite the presidential advisors' fervent hopes and queries, however, it was not credible to assert that Saddam actually had helped plan or helped to support the September 11th attack. The connection between Saddam and 9/11 would have to be metonymically and metaphorically made. If Saddam could be linked to terrorism by giving stipends to the families of suicide bombers or even harboring terrorists on his own national soil, a rhetorical, if not empirical, association to 9/11 could be constructed. He had, in fact, given money to suicide bombers. He had allowed a small terrorist group inside his national boundaries, engaged in state terrorism, committed gross human rights violations, ethnic cleansing, and mass murder. Each of these issues was placed on the table by the scripters of, quote, Iraq. Through such metonymic relationships, it might be possible to build a metaphorical bridge to 9/11. This would make it easier to draw powerful moral sustenance from the binary representations of the originating trauma. If the ability of the Iraq protagonist could be so deepened, the invasion could perhaps be narrated as salvation. Even these imaginative constructions, however, did not meet the symbolic requirements of the day. To be sure, a majority of Americans were well misled, 57% still believing the fictive linkages to be undeniable fact 15 months after the invasion. The serial relationship between Saddam's actions in Iraq and 9/11 at home, however, were too extended. The danger remained too far from home. The victims of Saddam's terrorist efforts were of little interest to most Western audiences. Such narrowness of empathic imagination suggests moral failure. It also had significant sociological effect. For Western audiences, Saddam was evil, but he did not seem seriously or world historically evil. He did not seem like a threat to the moral and physical existence of life in the West. So the serial relation would have to become fused. To be truly evil, Saddam needed to be linked to a world historical crime. This semiotic demand led to the assertion that Saddam possessed, had used, and would use again weapons of mass destruction, the famously labeled WMDs, capitalized into an acronym that were scripted lavishly and spoken of in hushed tones. If such weapons did exist, and about that there was said to be certainty, and if we lived in an age of global transportation and transmission, which was undeniable, then it was only a matter of time before these weapons of horror would strike at Americans, and before that, at Israelis, and possibly also Europeans. To write WMDs into the script was to evoke the previous century's most apocalyptic events. Chemical weapons had terrorized tens of thousands of soldiers during the First World War. Nuclear weapons had killed hundreds of thousands at the end of World War II. WMDs and their possible victims also, of course, recalled another, quote, mass of sacred evil. The mass murder of the Jews that became the Holocaust, the terrifying symbol of evil that continually threatened to darken modernity's good name. It was for these reasons of symbolic logic that WMDs became central to the Iraqi invasion script. The weight of evility could now be postulated. As President Bush gravely intoned in an invasion speech on March 17, 03, in this century, when evil men plot chemical, biological, and nuclear terror, a policy of appeasement would bring destruction of a kind never before seen on Earth. This apocalypse. With the WMDs, for many, a preemptive strike could be made to seem not only reasonable, but redemptive. As Bush said, waiting for the act, waiting to act after American foes have, quote, struck, is not self-defense, it's suicide. But if this script now worked aesthetically, could it be made to walk and talk, to work pragmatically as well? Could the script be put into practice such that it would produce performances with which audiences would identify and stand up and applaud? To create such dramaturgical fusion, audiences must be convinced that performances are not faked or artificial. They have to be convinced of the verisimilitude of the performance, that they are authentic and true aesthetically and morally. It was just this necessity that led to the play within the play. The WMD-centered script had to be pretested in an out-of-town performance. The actor was American Secretary of State Colin Powell. The stage was the emergency meeting of the UN Security Council. The time was early February 2003. Social performances are historically and not only geographically layered. Secretary Powell's appearance was recognized as an iteration, both by his production team and his incipient critics, of an earlier iconic moment during another national crisis. Adlai Stevenson, John Kennedy's American ambassador to the United Nations and a hero of the Democratic left, had turned in a bravado performance at an emergency meeting of the UN Security Council during the Cuban Missile Crisis nearly four decades before. President Bush and his aides had chosen Secretary of State Colin Powell because he too was popular with the liberal left, despite his Republican Party affiliation. He was reputed to be honest and bold, and he was thought to be politically independent. Alone among the president's men, Powell's performative utterances would not be immediately framed in a partisan way. The American and global audience would likely hear him out, looking relaxed and sure of himself and making ample use of visual aids. Secretary Powell seized the podium and dramatically put the administration's tailored and scripted assertions, or big lies, into the global civil sphere. When it was over, he felt that he had, quote, given the performance of his life. Many segments of his American audience, many fewer in his European, seemed to agree. Polling support in the U.S. bumped up sharply. The success of Colin Powell's global performance was not preordained. Its fusion had to be achieved. It was not ascribed. That it was successful transformed the performance from dress rehearsal into prologue. What quickly followed, the dramatic opening scene of the Iraq invasion, was characterized in terms of the sublime, shock and awe. While success came easily, it was too immaculate. For in the days immediately leading up to the invasion and those that quickly followed it, the dramaturgical justifications for blood sacrifice ran into deep trouble. As I've suggested earlier, effective scripting depends on agonism. The tension between sacred and profane must be sustained so that the zigzag reversals that make plots interesting can lead to cathartic resolution. This agonism was undermined, however, by two events on the ground, contingent and unscripted happenings that threatened the hegemonic script. The first was Saddam's agreement to cooperate with, rather than to confront, the new Security Council resolutions, allowing weapons inspectors relatively free access to look around Iraq. They traveled through Iraq investigating putative weapons sites. Of course, the meaning and motivation of Saddam's accession were ambiguous, and the effectiveness of the inspection process were far from transparent. But taken together, they manifestly weakened the cut of the agonists' evility and threaten to undermine the tense agonism being constructed by the war script. Eventually, these inspectors, headed by a grave and stolid Swedish diplomat, asked the UN for more time in order to be rational and fair. By opposing this request, the US and UK and their allies in the developing war coalition publicly and dramatically broke with the democratic procedural process of the Security Council. This cast a bad light and possibly even a polluting shadow on those who would be the war's moral protagonists, foreshadowing their own potential for evility in turn. These unscripted, symbolically realigning events led to the breakup of the Western Democratic Alliance. The American-led military party adopted a go-it-alone attitude, a self-described coalition of the willing that, despite its civil-sounding label, also connoted a gang or a posse. That was certainly how Europe skeptics saw it. Bush was playing the gunslinging cowboy, leading a lynch mob. The response of the American war directors was to pollute these critics as old Europe, suggesting that they were connected to the crises and weaknesses that had brought on the great apocalypse of mid-century. But the split was real, and it became even more difficult to frame the resort to violence in a consensual and democratic way. The split increased the distance then between the civil and military narratives that swirled around the initial days of the Iraqi war. From the invasion's earliest moments, there developed among significant American and Western audiences a counter-coding and counter-narration opposing the script projected by the governments of America and its allies. In this emerging counterscript, it would be the American President Bush, who was inscribed as a symbol of arbitrary authority and violence, not Saddam. It would be Bush who projected a dangerous and polluting aura, whose honesty and sincerity were doubted, whose motives were projected as irrational, and whose actions generated fear. Coalition military and civilian leaders had predicted that the performance of Iraqi freedom, as it was called, would not only be successful instrumentally, routing the Iraqi army, but theatrically. Audiences of Iraqi citizens would welcome the soldiers as liberators with flowers in their hands, and the subsequent installation of democracy would justify America's warrior myth in civil terms. This did not occur. After the dispersal of Saddam and his army, conspicuous groups of Iraqis began publicly looting their national treasures, not only destroying their own patrimony, but carrying away vital icons marking the very beginnings of civilization. Because American soldiers looked the other way, refusing to block this profanation, the civil side of the democratic warrior balance was destabilized. More doubt was cast on the master narrative of liberation that was to legitimate the military founding of civil society in the Middle East. Soon the narrative of military triumph was subject to challenge. Coalition control became undermined by a growing insurgency, countering both the pragmatic effectiveness and the moral integrity of America's counterperformance against terror. The multiplicity of social powers, to use Michael Mann's concept, posed immense challenges to performative success. In the aftermath of the invasion, American forces failed to monopolize the means of violence. The military power of its invading army was too small, and they could not rely on support from the established Iraqi armed forces, which had been disbanded. This points to the dearth in administrative power as well. American administrators had no blueprint for occupation, the Pentagon having famously left the plans back home with the State Department in the United States. and the most experienced members of the Iraqi administration were purged in the course of de-Ba'athization. America thus created its own counterpowers, an underground leadership, administrative staff, and armed insurgency that further undermined not only the effectiveness of its military force, but its chances for sympathetic framing and interpretation by Iraqi audiences. Tone-deaf American political authorities failed to find ways to bridge the yawning problems of sectarian rule. As it became increasingly clear that the Shiite Muslims exercised effective cultural control, possessing, in other words, not only counter-military and administrative, but ideological power, the connections between American occupying forces and both Iraqi and American domestic audiences became ever more attenuated and diffused. The global audiences, of course, were fragmented as well. The early pro- and anti-American splits within Western audiences deepened throughout the post-invasion period. Events seemed to confirm the initially skeptical counter-narratives of influential intellectuals and political elites in such nations as Germany, France, Italy, and Spain. These and other critical reviews of the unfolding military performance constructed barriers between European publics and coalition actions that were very difficult to breach. These barriers did not prevent the coalition from waging war. They undermined its symbolic power for legitimate war making. The resulting instability and chaos and the resurgence of intense anti-American feelings affected an extraordinary rhetorical transformation in the scripting of the war. The American army gradually but unmistakably shifted from liberator to occupier in the symbolic space, from the democratic to the anti-democratic side. This new labeling was deployed as much by American journalists as others. This symbolic transformation crystallized and exacerbated the shifting fortunes of America's symbolic justification for war. As the WMDs failed to appear in the days, then weeks, and months after the invasion, the anti-democratic construction of American action, or the construction of American action as anti-democratic, became more deeply etched, for the language of deceit and political manipulation became harder to avoid. The revelations of systematic torture at Abu Ghraib, publicity about secret CIA kidnappings and renditions, the Supreme Court's ringing declaration that holding enemy aliens without trial and representation was anti-constitutional, the exposure of NSA domestic spying without prior warrant, these revelations further denied American status as democratic antagonist. The binary signifiers of the discourse of American civil society remained powerful, but American actors failed to wrap themselves in its sacred side. Unable to implant this discourse in social signifieds, the war project failed. The stage of Iraqi freedom was evacuated. The Americans in Iraq were increasingly constructed as colonial oppressors who would have to exit stage right if Iraqis were ever to become free. Yet the Iraqis themselves seemed less and less to be constructed as having the capacity for freedom, as sectarian militia and death squads took murderous aim not only at Americans, but at one another. While the war's military outcome has not been finally settled, in performative terms, it's clearly in shambles. As we have seen, a good part of the reason for this failure belongs to the difficulty of formulating an effective script, one that could mediate between the background triumphs, the background traumas and triumphs, and the actual exigencies of geopolitical realities. Performative failure must also be attributed to the difficulties of making the script walk and talk on the ground, to the unexpected actions of Iraqi citizens, leaders, and insurgents, to the incompetent and undemocratic actions of American officials in Iraq and at home, to the plurality of social powers, and to the fragmentation of audiences in the U.S. and abroad. In the arc that stretches from the restorative communitas of 9/11 to the bitter military, political, and ideological polarization of today, we observe not only the defeat of a great nation's military project, but its demoralization. In performative terms, we see symbolic inversion and evacuation, a drama whose unfolding was blocked and whose meaning seems at once elusive and dangerously incomplete. As the American War Party has been pushed from the sacred to the profane, the very symbolic identity of the enemy has wobbled and become diffuse. The figure of Saddam has shifted from vainglorious and threatening dictator to hermit trickster hiding in the hole, to dazed and unkempt prisoner, to raving defendant, before finally coming to rest as the first hectoring, then hectored, then seemingly dignified victim of a botched, if perhaps still cosmically justified, execution. In the course of this resignifying process, the iconic Saddam as evil slipped away, and a more comic and ridiculous figure emerged. The good and evil positions as originally plotted have disappeared. But the soon-to-be-empty stage will not quickly become the setting for an imminent triumph. For Western critics, at least, no sacred and compelling narrative has emerged from the insurgent side. 40 years ago, in an earlier military debacle, the apparently humanistic and compelling narratives of socialism and national liberation made America's enemies, Ho Chi Minh, the Viet Cong, and the National Liberation Front, seem attractive to significant audiences and elite critics inside and outside the United States. Today, by contrast, there is little enthusiasm, even among the war's fiercest opponents, for the sectarian ideologies, political organizations, and leaders, much less the tactics of America's enemies in Iraq. Without a sacred place to stand, it is difficult to represent evil. If America has been murderous and invasive, without good reason or just cause, how can we condemn those who have opposed the invasion? Some critics have called the Iraqi war a tragedy, others a stupid and unforgivable farce. It is now beyond good and evil, neither sacred nor profane, it has become mundane. Thanks.
The way you operationalize the idea of social performance is very interesting, and I enjoyed listening to what you had to say. But it seemed to me throughout that it's more of a metaphor rather than a tool or a method of analysis. The usage of linguistic theories of speech act, signified and signifier, pragmatics, all this was placed or used metaphorically and not analytically. This is one thing that I'd like you to comment on. The other point is that I, again, as one script in fragmented audiences, whereas as an Arab person watching Al Jazeera throughout the events you described, I listened to a completely different script, and I would say that there are always many, many parallel scripts, if we're going to use that metaphor, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for those remarks. I think, as for the first comment, my philosophy of science would suggest that there's no difference between a metaphor and a model or a theory. And I think that I'm on pretty good grounds to argue that. I think that, in fact, this is an analytic model, that it produces sets of propositions. But yes, they're based on analogies and metaphors, and throughout the history of natural science, and even more so social science, metaphorical analogies are the basis for theoretical success, as in the notion of system or whatever. But if it becomes interesting and if it creates new understandings, then it works and it becomes an analytic. But I completely agree with your last comment. I mean, as I hope I made clear in the talk, the entire premise of this event was the split between West and East, which I addressed in the first third, but I did not speak about the anti-American side in the Middle East or the Arab media, of course. But I completely agree. It was and is counter-scripted, and I would like to carry out that research, and I would think that, so in the latter part where I talk about from triumph to trauma and performative failure, it would be quite the opposite. So that gives you a sense on the Arab side, which would be from trauma to triumph and performative success. And this is very important. In other words, what is a defused and failed performance from the American side is a refused and successful performance on the Arab side. And what a successful performance does, as Nietzsche was one of the first to point out, is it creates myth that's believed. And so what we have is the degradation and failure of our myth, in a sense, and the sustenance of another myth. And if we want to understand performance and symbolics and myth in the contemporary world, we need to be very sensitive to this fragmentation.
I'd like to ask people here and people in Lancaster to identify themselves before they speak. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Ann Taves, on the faculty here in the Religious Studies Department. I'd like to ask a question, have you elaborate a little bit more on the underlying model that you're using. I'm particularly interested in how you're using sacred and profane. And I understand that you're building off of Durkheim. And I'm also assuming that in following him, you're talking about sacred and profane as attributed or ascribed qualities. But what I'm not clear about is if those particular words carry particular import for what you're talking about, or if the underlying issue is really one of symbolic binaries. Because in listening to you, you used good and evil a lot. You used, in effect, heroes and villains. So would any of those have substituted equally well for sacred and profane? And if the real issue is the symbolic binaries, then are you making a further claim about the importance of symbolic binaries in terms of constructing effective performances? And if that's true, then I'm wondering about the value of, or the implications of binaries and binary thinking for performances and the kinds of myths that creates, and whether that's really all that helpful.
Well, thank you. I think that the way I'm going to answer this would lead to you to ask another, to make another statement about why they're not helpful, which you didn't have a chance to articulate, because I would plead guilty to every question you asked. I would say first, the sacred and profane, which I take, yes, from the late Durkheim, the later Durkheim, as filtered through Mary Douglas's fundamental work in Purity and Danger, and other people like Eliade and others. It is a binary, and it is connected to structural linguistics and structural anthropology, which showed from Saussure on that meaning is relational and it's organized in binaries. The difference between what I would suggest and a purely semiotic understanding is that these aren't simply, the codes I'm interested in aren't just binaries, but are weighted binaries morally. And that moves us back to the sacred and the profane, because as as Durkheim should have made more clear, and as Kai Waugh clarified in the 30s and 40s, there's really the sacred, profane, and the mundane, with the mundane being unweighted binary semiotic codes. Now, good and evil, yeah. I think that good and evil are the secular equivalents of the sacred and profane. And then the question becomes waiting. Heroes and villains, not exactly, because for me, hero and villains are parts of narration, not coding. For me, coding is a binary process and narrating is a temporal process. And so the heroes and villains are the way of mapping the binaries into an ongoing script. And those are very strong requirements, I think, to create meaning, to have all these in play and to work, and to relate them to more mundane ongoing events and the different elements of performance that I've mentioned. I would say that they're very helpful, and because I do believe that people in all societies are obsessed with these. That doesn't mean there can't be mediations, thesis, antithesis, synthesis. There's always thirds. There's always resolutions. There's always the hope that someday the world will be unified, etc. But I doubt it.
Back to you.
Any questions for Lucien? Okay. I'm just taking over the mic.
Hello? Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, thank you. My name is David Galbraith. I teach here at Lancaster, Department of Innovation and Enterprise. I'm really interested on a more practical level, if I can, just to find out from you, well, if you can inform us about a few things. I think we've been getting the impression for some time now that what's been influencing Bush and some of the higher echelons in politics in America has been the impact of the new evangelical right for some time, with a rather reductionist and kind of simplistic theology backing it. I wonder whether, you know, to some extent, in recent months, there may have been some kind of fragmenting of that influence, and also whether I'd like to know how influential perhaps new other kind of Christian blocs are in America now, perhaps supported by people like Jim Wallis and people like that.
It's about the role of the Christian right.
Christian right evangelical, yeah. Bloc in the United States, and how influential you see it today.
Well, I think that the Christian, fundamentalist Christian support for Bush, which has always been so important, is, I would see it as the metaphysical part of his sacred and profane civil binaries and military. In other words, I don't think that the Christian right is in any way responsible for the emphasis on good and evil and sacred and profane in the discourse of the United States. It's as strongly shared by atheists as it is by Christians or Christian fundamentalists. It's bigger than both of us. Nonetheless, the fact that, you know, 20 or 25% of Americans understand or understood the wars unfolding as in a metaphysical or metaphysically theological way, of course, was very significant. But I think perhaps what's happened is that as the performance fell to shreds, the non-metaphysical understanding of the sacred and profane separated to anti-Bush position. I think if you don't have the metaphysical component, it's much easier to seize the binaries and turn them against the president. Although I do want to emphasize, and I think that's what happened in the last election. I think if you want, the civil religion of the United States isn't the same as Christianity. And they can be turned, they can be separated from one another and are in various circumstances.
Hello, I'm Juan Campo from the Department of Religious Studies at UCSB. And I was fascinated by your performative analysis of the 9/11 attacks and the components that came together to make that such a visually stunning and horrifying kind of event, and also how they may have actually been produced by a figure like Osama bin Laden. And that kind of raises more questions into wanting to look more carefully at the performative aspects that lay behind bin Laden and the thinking of the participants in that particular attack. And this raises the issue, I think, that was raised earlier by one of the members of the Lancaster audience, is that, in fact, as you unraveled it in terms of the dimensions of performative and metaphoric activity in the United States after that event, I think you have to look back to the complexity of the discourses and performative narratives that were present in the world in which Osama bin Laden scripted these kinds of attacks. On the one hand, it's the kind of anti-crusader kind of discourse, which you made reference to, I think, with the 1,000 years of antipathy between Christianity and Islam. But there's also the element of reliving the narrative of the Prophet Muhammad, who's gone on retreat to a remote area to engage in a war, from a cave even, against the unbelievers. So you have the belief and the unbelief element coming in, and you can unravel that further and further. But I would also think that it's not just a matter of his giving a performance or scripting a performance that was going to have the Western audience, but also one that would have a more resonating effect in terms of, as you mentioned briefly, an Arab audience, but one which he saw not as all people that would align with him, but one where he realized there were contending scripted performances going on at the same time, because rather than going with an antipathy between East and West, don't you also have these narratives about how many people are becoming globalized and becoming more and more appropriating elements from the West, whether it's in dress styles, secular forms of education that are permeated the countries. You go to Saudi Arabia, they have a whole narrative about how the Saudis, Bedouin, are like the American cowboys, and they're constantly comparing themselves to Texans. So you have those kinds of narratives, U.S. TV shows and dramas being rewritten or re-scripted for local TV programming and things like that, even to the point of game shows. So it seems to me that Osama is not guaranteed the kind of unified kind of response, which I think you suggested, to his performance, because he's dealing with these contending performances. And so I'd like you to sort of recognize that, and also the fact that for many of the peoples that are found in the Middle East and beyond, it may not even be a matter so much of the performances of Muhammad or the Crusaders that's in their mind as part of their narrative, but also very recent colonial history, where they have narratives of conflicts and memorials for heroes who died in those conflicts against colonial powers. So I was wondering if you could fit in those anti-colonial kind of narratives too into this, and how, in a sense, the U.S. effort to extend its performance to go from a one-night stand to a Broadway run in Iraq, whether that might have in fact awakened these anti-colonial discourses, and even more beyond what Osama bin Laden could do with his.
I can only say amen to that. You know, you've done just what I would like to do if I had the knowledge, you know, the means and the motive to explore that. I think it's, you're right, I cheated in the sense of saying his performance was a fused performance. Obviously it wasn't, as the audience, they're more complex and fragmented audiences who had many different kinds of reactions to this. So I think, yes, the important thing, his success is a developing processual project, and he's very, very concerned with media and symbolism and projection. But his ability to speak to Western audiences, whether they're Muslim or not, is somewhat limited, but he is doing a lot of speaking inside of the non-Western world, all over the world, but this meets with mixed success. I think one thing the United States doesn't understand and didn't understand in Vietnam is that our participation is essential to his success. And if the United States withdrew, for example, what would happen to his need to have an agonistic script, etc.? There'd be a plural civil war. Another way of talking about a civil war is the pluralization and fragmentation of scripted performances. If we weren't there, what would happen to success and legitimation? Not that I'm welcoming that.
Any questions here? Okay, we've got the question just coming.
Hi, Patrick Carr, postgraduate in the Religious Studies Department here. If we're living in what you called a mundane situation, one where the comedic, in inverted commas, obviously, means the reversal of the sacred and profane and the instability of the sacred and profane. What future do you see for communitas, Victor Turner's notion of communitas, in the West, and perhaps in terms of the nation states now, if those boundaries between sacred and profane can't be maintained steadily? Thank you.
Yeah, that's an important question. I think that what I would say is that each collective performance, it has a kind of boundary, and even though it's a vague one, it's a project. And this project has come to a crashing end, and one way that it's ended the way this project has ended is in the mundane and the comic, I think. I mean, there are other narratives. There's narratives about the troops, and they are tragic ones. You can build narratives about the destruction of Iraqi society as a tragedy. I wouldn't make the following statement, that we are in a mundane period now. I'd say this project is beyond good and evil. By that I mean that there isn't a triumph of a good on the other side from the point of view of most Western audiences. So there's really no possibility of salvation. But at the same time, given the basic structure of Western, if we're talking about that Western culture, we're not beyond good and evil in any sense of the term. And we can see that in the United States, the Democrats are striving to wrap themselves in the sacred of the civil religion, and they're trying to build on the Moore's construction of Bush as not only comic, or perhaps just comic, but also evil. And so the play of signifiers is always there, and it's charged by the tension, I think, between sacred and profane in American culture. The challenge for the West, if you want to put it that way, which is a terrible construction, but it's too detailed, it should always come with an asterisk after it, is to narrow the construction of the profane and to get out, perhaps, of a war on terror framework and to find other ways of implotting sacred and profane. I don't think that this kind of stuff can just be a police action. In other words, be mundane. That's not going to sell, it's not going to work, it's not going to ennoble, it's not going to energize. But there are very different ways of creating a project of salvation and transcendence, and that's what I'm hoping would be possible at some point.
Nick?
Yes, Nick Entrekin from UCLA Geography and the International Institute. As you know, the idea of narrative and the coherence of narrative is something that holds together both a temporal and a spatial dimension. That those working together give that narrative a certain power. And when one translates that to discussions of performance and links it to the idea of the stage and the ability to design the stage, I think some interesting questions come up, and I wonder if you're going to be considering these. And the example that I'll use is just the kind of cartography of geopolitics that's part of this, the representation of the spaces that are where this performance is taking place, in a sense, the representation of the stage. So that if you just take the Western representation of this through both the Bush administration and the military, that the early stages there was a kind of coherent spatial logic to this related to the nation state of Iraq within the borders of Iraq. Actually, we can even move back before that. If one goes back to Afghanistan, there was a sense in the representation of Afghanistan as this spatial whole that could be rid of the Taliban, and that there would be a kind of spatial control over that area. And one sees in the representation in the media large state diagrams and so on, but also I can think of almost comic representations on CNN where they had three-dimensional maps where the commentator and a general would be literally walking over the space of this nation, almost as giants in another land. But if you look at Iraq, there was a logic that tied in the state space with a regional space, and there was a narrative of what the gradual process of democratization would, the kind of spatial logic of that process. One sees in recent representations of it a complete breakdown of that spatial logic now, so that if you see, for example, in the Sunday New York Times, the representation of the space of this new strategy in Iraq is almost based upon the local neighborhoods of Baghdad, that the idea of the state, that the whole story has become so fragmented that we're now looking at various kinds of ethnic neighborhoods and control of particular neighborhoods and so on. And then that is tied to a larger kind of geopolitical discussion of Iran in the region, but there's no coherence to this. There's a micro geography to it and a kind of macro geopolitics where the story is not linked very well, and it's a kind of fragmented fragmentation of the narrative that undermines the logic of it. Is this something that you see as part of the story you want to tell on this particular topic of examining the spatial logic and its fragmentation?
Well, if you and I had continued to be colleagues, you could have helped me to do that. And yes, my answer to that is yes. I think I've left out the notion of the means of symbolic production and the mise-en-scene, these two elements cry out for, you know, a deeper spatialization and reaching out to space. In a successful performance, a space, to use your own earlier work, a space becomes a place, becomes more home-like. It seems natural. This is where it should happen, this kind of thing. When performances don't work and they seem artificial, they don't seem to be resting comfortably in a place, or maybe no place at all. And I think you're suggesting just that kind of thing. There's an abrupt shift. So now the scene, the stage is Baghdad. What happened to Iraq? You know, what can a narrative that was about freeing a nation be relocated to this small capital? I think that in the Cold War, the Iron Curtain was a great spatial metaphor for seeing a division of the world, and colors were used and things like that, Western versus Eastern Europe, tearing down the wall. The War on Terror is not really spatially, it's hard to operationalize it spatially without confusing things and there are so many countries in the Middle East that are not terrorist, that aren't, and yet they're also quite evil in terms of the American civil religion. So things get mighty confused there, and I think that perhaps one of the difficulties of the binary of war on terror is its difficulty to specialize this.
Somebody over there?
Two Pauls wanting to ask, but I'll give it to the other Paul first.
Thank you. Paul Fletcher, who teaches religious studies here at Lancaster. I just wanted to ask a question about the kind of performance that we're referring to, and wondered whether the kind of material production of this performance, that most of what you've been describing, is in a sense mediated to us by 24-hour rolling news programs, apparently within real-time interface. And the reason why I think that kind of mediation might be important is that it seems to me that one of the things that trauma does is actually create a zone of indistinction between the sacred and the profane, partly because the definition of trauma is that, in a sense, it's something which is unsayable. It can't truly be mourned and moved beyond without significant delay. And if that is right, that trauma creates this distinction between the profanation of the sacred and the sacralization of the profane, then surely the very fact that something like September 11th, 2001 occurred on television prevented the kind of delay that would be necessary to pursue a different type of politics. That it was almost because of this means of communication that there could only be response and no real true delay. Delay for reflection, delay for thought, and delay is the possibility of politics. And so in a sense, what I'm trying to suggest is that maybe in many respects, the sorry affair or tragedy is created because the conditions of its possibility are trauma.
Well, that's a very coherent argument. It depends, of course, on the premise that a traumatic event in itself makes distinction between sacred and profane difficult, and that the immediacy of the material communication makes it impossible to have the time to reconstruct an effective response, presumably, which would involve reactivating these divisions. And I'm not sure I'm convinced by either of those premises. I do think that trauma, and I've written about this a couple of years ago, trauma is a construction process, and it has to be. You have a lot of debate immediately about who were the victims, what was done, who are the perpetrators, what we should do in response. What I would disagree, I think that trauma potentially dissolves the sacred and profane distinction, but the trauma work for a collectivity we're talking about is precisely to reinscribe and articulate those distinctions. And I think that was done in the case of September 11th. I think there was a sense of ours. Where was the president? What was he going to say? There was a lot of debate on 24-hour television about what was happening. Bush's speech and American intellectuals' reflections and Europeans were all attempts to reinscribe the event. So when LeMond wrote, "We are all Americans now," that was a way of understanding who were the victims in a certain way. And then I think there was this period of 6 weeks, or however many weeks it was, several weeks before the Iraq invasion, when a lot of things were open. This was a period of a lot of discussion. And the challenge was to relate it back to the trauma in some way. And then after the invasion, there was a long period of time where there was no necessary movement into Iraq, and it was a difficult time for symbolic politics.